Well, as we heard on the news with Tony earlier on the program, Australia's export of live animals has been in the spotlight again this week following the launch of a class action. Northern cattle producers are suing the federal government for damages, arguing the ban on live exports to Indonesia in 2011 was reckless and caused significant financial loss. You might remember the ban was prompted by revelations on the ABC's Four Corners program of horrific abuse of cattle in Indonesian abattoirs, abuse that the RSPCA has said was systemic in Indonesia. Well, this week we've heard from a few Labor MPs, current and former, who say that ban was a mistake. One of those is Simon Crean, former Minister for Regional Australia and in that position at the time of the ban, and now the new face of the Australian Livestock Exporters Council. He retired, you may remember, at the last federal election. So why jump back into a public role that's so controversial? Reporter Kath McAloon asked him why a quiet life after politics didn't appeal.
Well, I was interested by the challenge. It's an industry that I've always had not just an interest in, I've had a long association with it since the early 80s, really, and had ministerial responsibility in a number of different capacities. It's an industry that has a really strong future in my view. It caters for a specific demand that's not going away, it's growing. Before I agreed, I needed to be convinced that it was an industry prepared to face up to the problems that led to the closure of the trade. In other words, the acceptance of the social licence, the need to effect a better way of ensuring the supply chain and the humane treatment of animals through all stages. And I guess the final point, when I really put my mind to it, is that given I was part of a government that led to the closure of the trade, I also felt something of an obligation to the industry to try and do something to not help get it back on its feet, but to continue that trajectory, that growth path, but a sustainable growth path.
Just to that point, you were Regional Australia Minister in the Gillard government when the trade was suspended in 2011. Looking back now, do you think your government acted appropriately?
No, I think it was the wrong decision, and I said so at the time. But I'm interested not looking back, I'm interested in looking forward. I'm delighted that the Northern Australian Forum concept is continuing. One of the key areas of opportunity that was then identified for Northern Australia was the live cattle industry. This is an industry worth supporting. It's an industry that plays a significant role in addressing the issue of food security to a growing regional market that is increasingly looking to protein in its diet, and as its standards of living increase, that's only going to hasten. But again, it's a question not just of identifying the market access, but of understanding the social license dimension as well.
Just on that social license, and I guess you touched on some of the welfare, animal welfare issues that have sort of plagued the live export industry. Will that be a priority of yours to restore public confidence in the industry?
Well, it's a priority for the industry. I think the industry understood the problem that ended up in. Forget about the closure of the trade, it was the public reaction that couldn't be ignored.
So how will you do that?
I think by the steps that have been taken out of that 2011 exercise, the establishment of the supply chain, the quality assurance, that is an essential part. And we've heard reports today of the progress in that. There's ongoing work that has to be done there. But when you ask me, how do we start addressing it? It's already started to be addressed. I think the closure of the Indonesian market also highlighted the problem of the need to diversify market access, not just become reliant on one market. You become vulnerable to it, but there is a risk management issue in terms of market access, as well as the social licence?
Just to the supply chain, we did hear this morning from Philip Glyde from the Department of Agriculture about some of the challenges. Is it a workable system? Does it need major reforms? I guess he sort of talked about how it's received in those importing countries. Will it ever work when sort of Australian organisations are expected to be exerting influence in foreign markets?
Well, I think that's the wrong way to cast it. I think it's a shared responsibility. We've tried to operate not just in terms of other countries, but through international standards. And the international body has recognised Australia as the world leader. Now, this is another example, I think, of where Australia needs to stay in the game, not only in terms of the supply of the product that is increasingly being demanded, but the way in which it is supplied.
Are tougher penalties needed as part of that SCAS system? We haven't seen anyone yet barred from exporting, despite breaches.
Yeah, I think it's the commitment. There needs to be, in all of those things, some understanding of sanctions. But I don't think you start just with the tougher penalties. I think the industry is confident about its ability to guarantee, if it was allowed to operate, we don't do it inhumanely in this country. And if that's the case, if we can do it in a humane way here, it's that model that we've got to help project. Rather than just look at the penalty argument, I think that the bigger issue to look at is capability building in those other countries.
Simon Crean, the new chair of the Australian Livestock Exporters Council. Now to the nation's peak scientific research body, the CSIRO. It's faced its share of budget cuts and staff losses in recent times, and some argue it's at an all-time low. But it recently welcomed a new CEO, a former technology entrepreneur and venture capitalist. Dr. Larry Marshall is a Sydney-born physicist who's as at home in Silicon Valley as he is on the drought-affected farms of Queensland. And he has some ambitious plans for research and a great interest in the role of agriculture, including, as he calls it, some big, scary goals. He's speaking with our political reporter, Lucy Barber.
So my dad and my uncle both grew up on a farm in Goolagong, central New South Wales, and I spent pretty much every summer working there as a kid, so I had quite a bit of exposure to farming.
So what sort of farm was that?
They did mostly wheat and some pigs and quite a few chickens.
So now you're about to take up your role as chief executive of the CSIRO. Do you think there needs to be more funding injected into agricultural research within the CSIRO?
So CSIRO has a big hairy goal, a big scary goal, and that is it's our mission to increase yield and production efficiency to deliver a 30% increase in productivity across the ag sector. That's a very, very tough goal, but it's absolutely something that a world-class science organisation like CSIRO should be doing. We live in a very arid country, so water is critical. So it's kind of one area. My cousin is on a cattle property in northern Queensland, and his life is literally a battle for water. So I'm very familiar with his pain. I mean, they have a party every time it rains more than 5 mil, and to us in the city, that's not very much. But if you're on the land depending on rain to grow your grass, to feed your cattle, it's an incredibly scarce and valuable resource.
If you were to come up with an example of the sort of research project in terms of water you'd like to see the CSIRO carry out beyond what it's done already, what might that look like?
If you look at what we've done already, coming up with better ways to manage water, to quantify, for example, the project in the Murray-Darling Basin, exactly where the water is, how much of it there is, how it can be extracted, and the economics and logistics of that. I think we need to do more of that, and we are. We're across many other water deposits now, both in Australia and globally. Beyond that, this is a little bit out there, but something that has always fascinated me, I don't know if you've ever seen farmers find water. And as a scientist, I can't explain how they do this, but there's a number of tricks when people douse for water. And I can tell you, I've seen people do this with close to 80% accuracy, no idea how they do it. But when I see that as a scientist, it makes me question, is there instrumentality that we could create that would enable a machine to find that water. I've always wondered whether there's something in the electromagnetic field or in gravitation anomaly. It's the kind of those kind of projects I think we need to push the envelope to see what we can do. Remember, our mission fundamentally is to do whatever we can in terms of creation of technology and support for the land to enable our farmers to be globally competitive.
So can we expect to see some research dollars being invested in that particular area?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm going to take the very good advice of my more level-headed scientists who probably understand a lot more about this than I do, but it's definitely a question that I'm going to ask. You know, if you know my background, I'm a venture capitalist in the US, or have been, and been over there for about 25 years. In the last 10 years, venture has had absolutely zero interest in the land. The obsession has been in the internet. Now, what's interesting to me is that in the last year, the top tier US venture capitalist, the people at the very peak of the pyramid who lend the trends, they've started asking me and others about agriculture. They've started to wake up to the fact that there's a huge global problem if we don't figure out how to be more efficient in producing food to keep up with the Earth's growing population. So my prediction is in the next 10 years, a lot of that venture money is going to get redeployed, because after all, how many times can we reinvent the internet? That money will get redeployed to solve real-world problems on the land. And I think CSIRO is in an amazing position to benefit from that, to capitalise on that.
In your opinion, has the CSIRO been under pressure to reduce research into climate change and climate adaptation?
As a CEO of a company, of a non-public company, or non-government funded company, I would be obsessed with one quarter and delivering my quarterly results, which are pure financial results. As CEO of CSIRO, I can't afford to be that short term. There'll still be increasing pressure on me and on my team to show more tangible, more monetary results from our research. But we can never lose sight of the fact that our core mission is to create long-term sustaining value for our country. And that in order to do that, we have to be looking a lot further out. We have to be willing to make investments in things that we believe will deliver very great value, sustainable value over the long term that will really differentiate Australia. And that's kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum of the short-term quarterly results. That's always the struggle.
Incoming CSIRO Chief Executive Dr. Larry Marshall speaking with Lucy Barber. And you can find an extended version of that interview online at abc.net.au/rural.